yesterday, that was Lee Morgan heading up the band, consisting of Jackie McLean on alto sax, Hank Mobley on tenor sax, Cedar Walton on piano, Paul Chambers on bass, and Billy Higgins on drums. The tune is titled The Double Up, and that's what we're doing today. We're doubling up on the theme that we established yesterday. There's more to add to it today, so I figured for continuity's sake, let's do that. Let's play the same music today. I like it anyway. Okay. As you know, there have been interesting developments in the case in Minneapolis against Derek Chauvin, who is charged with second degree and third degree murder and manslaughter in the death of George Floyd on May the 25th last year. And I would like to be modest about it, but there's no need. I did tell you, and in fact, we saw it happen yesterday in the court. And that is the planting of the seeds by the defense lawyer, whose job it is to deflect, to get people to look someplace else other than where they are looking or should be looking, and to pay attention to what he outlines as the major point in this case. And it seems, and I was right, we talked on this program about a central question that would arise based on what the temperament was in the court. You could pretty much predict it. And that is the question of how did George Floyd die? Did Derek Chauvin kill him? Or was something else the cause of George Floyd's death? Now, I told you that was going to arise, and it did. And now that it has, the attorney defending Derek Chauvin is going to stay on this point, so as to conjure up in the mind of the jurors that it is not a resolved matter. It is not a definite matter of how George Floyd died. I read you from the medical examiner's report. The medical examiner had said, George Floyd died as a result of cardiopulmonary arrest, complicating law enforcement subdual. That is when the officers were trying to arrest him and to keep him still. Restraint and neck compression. And then later on in the same medical examiner's report, he says, in describing significant conditions contributing to death, arteriosclerotic and hypertensive heart disease, fentanyl intoxication, and recent methamphetamine use. None of this mentions the fact that four police officers spent quite a bit of time with George Floyd trying to subdue him and restrain him and arrest him and he was resisting. So the medical examiner's report itself makes them absent from the discussion of cause of death and significant conditions contributing to death. They're not mentioned. Other things are mentioned that are related to disease, serious heart disease, and methamphetamine use and fentanyl intoxication. Do you see the point I was making? It does not directly implicate police officers. It certainly implicates George Floyd himself. After all, these substances could not have gotten into his body without him taking those substances. And apart from that, the other major point of concentration in the medical examiner's report was what I think he was trying to say was a history, and a very significant history, of serious heart problems. Cardiopulmonary arrest is what he suffered. In the course of being subdued, but he doesn't name the agency or the agent responsible for provoking this cardiopulmonary arrest. That is not what he's there for, I suppose. He's there simply to determine and to state, because this is about performing an autopsy and what his findings were. But I found it very interesting that there's a heavy emphasis on George Floyd's hypertensive heart disease, his arteriosclerosis, and then comes a very curious order. Then comes fentanyl intoxication and recent methamphetamine use. In other words, he places George Floyd and the ingesting of these substances, especially fentanyl and methamphetamine, at the approximate time of his encounter with these cops. Interesting. So from the minute this is mentioned, you have the defense attorney going on the attack, because now he feels much better. He feels comforted by the fact that an official document places blame for Floyd's death where? On George Floyd. Principally on George Floyd. And I suppose we will find out as the trial proceeds that Floyd will also be blamed for not coming clean, and maybe even taking this fentanyl and methamphetamines because he anticipated arrest. And this was the most convenient way to get rid of these heavy-duty drugs. He took them. He swallowed them. That's where they build. These are the building blocks. What I'm trying to demonstrate to you is that they drop it as hints. They drop it as information in a trial. But you have to listen very carefully about what the intention is and what they're hoping the result would be. The result would be that the defense now will pick up and carry the hints all the way through, so that it would not be out of order. It would not seem bizarre that the defense would take a position that George Floyd was actually responsible for his own death. Following? Okay. How so? The medical examiner's report does not note the consequence. It does not note the evidence to suggest that Chauvin was kneeling on his neck, on Floyd's neck, for what is now discovered to be 9 minutes and 29 seconds. That's a heck of a long time to deprive someone of oxygen and still act as if, well, this is just police procedure. If he had cooperated, he would not have put himself in danger. Except that we have a witness testifying yesterday who was a mixed martial arts person. And he testified that what he saw that troubled him so was the compression of George Floyd's neck by kneeling on it, and that was through the agency of Derek Chauvin. And he testified that he had a very quick exchange with Chauvin and said, that is a blood choke. And he testified that Chauvin acknowledged it. What is a blood choke? It means that you compress a person's airwaves so tightly that it literally controls the flow of blood, and in this case, as well as of oxygen, of air. And the result of a blood choke, well applied, is that it induces, it makes the person go limp. It makes the person lose consciousness. You see, things sometimes work out where people don't expect that ordinary people just testifying about what they saw can put a whole new slant on it. But let us not get away from the fact that the intention here is to plant the idea in the jurors' minds that it is quite possible that George Floyd possibly caused his own death. He possibly ingested all those drugs quickly in order to make them disappear, so there would be no evidence of him taking drugs. And this issue of cardiopulmonary arrest, which is a massive heart attack, Floyd had had problems, reportedly, with his heart. So this was not a new thing for him. He knew that this was something that he had. And now when you look at some of the tapes some of the outtakes, you can see the possibility that Floyd was very conscious of this, that what he was experiencing was in fact a heart attack brought on by the choking and brought on by the accelerated rate. If, I'm just putting it out there, I'm not a forensic scientist or anything, but in the event or the possibility that he swallowed any medications that he had that he was not supposed to have in that car, just as he was anticipating arrest, he was already in a hyper state. And this might just have put him over the edge and made his body over accelerate and produce what could be covered up as a heart attack, because it looks just like a heart attack, when in fact it was something else that caused the body to react that way. As I said, 9 minutes and 29 seconds standing on a person's neck is a very traumatic thing to experience. Even if you had a great working heart, it will respond because you are in a state of desperation. You can't breathe. And that's what George Floyd voiced several times. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. That was not a police tactic to subdue. The martial artist confirmed that to us in this testimony yesterday, when he said that was what in the martial arts world, and we know that Coven was a martial artist, he knew about these things. He called it a blood choke. So the fight is for the minds of the jurors. What are they likely to believe? And that's the question I'm going to ask you. If you were on that jury and you listened to the medical examiner's report, and that report was followed almost immediately by Chauvin's lawyers talking about the manner and cause of death, do you think you can get through the trial without remembering this? Without having a specific indication, because they're implicating George Floyd by inference. The medical examiner said that this might have happened. It might have happened this way, but that's not what he's supposed to say. He's supposed to say very specifically, with evidence backing it up, what his findings are. But he left it kind of murky, kind of undefined as to how did George Floyd, how exactly, what was the exact cause of death? And that leaves room, as I said yesterday, that leaves room for the defense to now follow through and raise the same question and build on that theme that we don't know and we can't say and we have no evidence from the authorities, not even from the medical examiner, that George Floyd essentially was choked to death. It doesn't say that. And that leaves the door wide open to cultivate more and more speculation and to implicate George Floyd in his own death. Had he not done these things, he could be alive today. But in desperation to avoid arrest, these are the things that he did. And it precipitated a massive reaction within his body, and his heart literally gave out. And therefore, it would be wrong to accuse the police officer, Chauvin, Derek Chauvin, of manslaughter of any type, first degree or third degree, or second degree, sorry. It just can't happen. This is not what happened, according to the medical examiner's report. And just plain common sense. That's what the defense will say. What do you say? At 888-874-4888. It's getting very interesting. It's going to get even more interesting. Because at the end of the day, somebody or some specific thing, some agent or agency, some way in which George Floyd died, and it can't be that he caused his own death. It can't be that. His conduct on that day suggested he was trying to be cooperative, but he was panicking. He was in a serious panic. He was about to be arrested, taken off the street, charged with a crime. And he had been down that road before. He didn't want to go there again. All right, let's see who we have on the phone today. Ed from Queens, you start us off on the question.
Good afternoon, Chief. How are you?
Okay, Ed, how are you doing?
Well, you know, me and the thumbs still here. Still
and you, your famous thumbs.
Me and my infamous thumbs. I don't know why you're so surprised. I mean, this is just classic blaming the victim. I mean, you have the coroner's. That's the problem with these cases. They did the same thing in the Eric Garner case. He was overweight. He had asthma. He was not in any type of shape. And any precipitating events could have caused him to die or could have been the cause of his death. They're trying to paint the same picture with Eric Garner, with Chauvin and all of this. It doesn't matter what physical condition the individual was in. The only thing that matters is, did the police officer's procedures instigate the circumstances for this man to die? This man wasn't just going to walk out in the street and drop dead, because that's what they're trying to make it sound like. Arterial sclerosis, congenital heart disease, the use of amphetamines, all to paint a picture of this guy was a walking physical wreck and anything could have killed him. And it just so happened that this day, the police officer happened to be there, happened to arrest him, and he happened to die. And that's what the defense's job is. But by the same token, that's what the state's job is. The coroner didn't have to write his report in that way. The defense is going to take that to raise reasonable doubt. in the minds of the jury. What the prosecutor has to do, if the prosecutor is sincere, is control that narrative. Make it known that Derek Chauvin knew exactly what he was doing, which is a good start based on the testimony of the martial arts expert, that he applied a chokehold, that because chokeholds compress the carotid artery. I've also been involved in martial arts, and there are several different kinds of chokeholds. They compress the carotid artery in the neck, stopping blood flow to the brain and causing unconsciousness. And that's the idea behind a chokehold, to incapacitate somebody by cutting off blood flow to the brain. If you do it for too long, you can kill someone. If you do it for too long and you're not proficient with it, you can cause brain damage or death. And that's the danger of a chokehold. That's why chokeholds are banned by NYPD. You can't use a chokehold to debilitate or someone, even though it's a very effective way to do it. And if Derek Chauvin knew this, and he instituted this chokehold for 9 minutes, he knew that this man was going to die. If he's a martial artist, he knows the consequences behind an improperly or too long held chokehold or blood hold, whatever you want to call it. He knows that blood is not going to the brain after I think about 6 minutes, brain cells start to die. And if he knew this, no matter what physical condition this man was in, he knew that this hold could and did kill him. And that's what's got to be proven. All the rest of the stuff is garnished for the defense to create reasonable doubt. And like I said before, the prosecutor's office has an incestuous relationship with the police. And you cannot depend on the prosecutor's office to go full force, to do due diligence, in my opinion, in a case like this, because they need the police. After all this is said and done, the prosecutor's office needs the police. And they're not going to alienate the
police. Let me ask you then, how will the prosecutor's office turn this around? Can the prosecutor's office turn the scenario around, which has been meticulously laid out for people to come to their own conclusions, and the conclusions that they would likely come to would be the ones that have been set out for them?
Isn't that difficult? I mean, the prosecutor controls the narrative to a certain extent. He controls it more in the indictment phase than the trial phase. But the bottom line is, you got to paint a picture that this Derek Chauvin knew what he was doing, that he has martial arts training, you got to look at his record. You got to look at his prior record. You got to see, that's why this is you got to look at his prior police record. Has he had other cases? Has he been abusive? Has he had cases of police violence or police brutality? You got to bring all that into the picture to show that this man had an intent, and he had the ability, he had the martial arts ability to apply this hold. He had the knowledge of what this hold could do, and he had the intent to use it. And that's where their prior relationship comes in. That's where I've heard prior to the trial, that they knew each other. And one worked as a bouncer, or they worked security at a club, and they had altercations there. All of these things have to be brought into bear if you want to prove intent and get this guy for murder. But I don't think they're going to do that, because, like I said, the incestuous relationship between the prosecutor, the DA, and the police is too deep. They don't want to alienate the police. They need them to prosecute cases. And they're not going to, it's like trying to kill your brother. They're not going to.
Well, we will see where it goes. But in the meantime, you did an excellent job of deciphering where the case is right now. And more importantly, how it is likely affecting people's minds, especially the jurors. David from Brooklyn, you're on the air. I thought about you today.
Listening to what you talked about at the start brings one thing to my mind. And that one thing is that the medical examiner, I guess is a public employee, I'm not sure, but he sounds like he was on the defense team for that Mr. Chauvin. I'm wondering if the family of Mr. Floyd got an independent autopsy of his body. The point is that it was written in the way the report by the medical examiner, if I understand what you said, put a lot of the onus for his death on his behavior in terms of using various drugs. But I think the important part of this is for the medical examiner to put out a report that definitively decided that his death was one of the activity of Mr. Chauvin in his death. You know, you can have all kinds of other things like use of drugs and so forth, and all kind of ailments that are wrong with a person. And yet, that is not what I think killed him in this case. It's the action of Mr. Chauvin. So the point is that that was not emphasized. What you've got to cross to us this morning, they're talking about all those other things. And whereas the important part is that the activity of Mr. Chauvin was what killed him rather than him taking those various drugs. I think that's important, and I hope that the family got their own medical examiner and to give an autopsy that would describe it more clearly, rather than the autopsy that we're talking about, given by a public employee that seems like he's on the defense team of Eric Chauvin.
Ooh. Well, thank you very much for that. I happen to agree. That's a very important point. Marcus from Wisconsin, you're on the air.
Marcus, you and your callers are providing probably the best, most lucid discussion on this topic that I've heard anywhere. So thank you for that. I'd like to offer what I think may be a helpful sort of regional perspective here from here in Wisconsin, Minnesota's next door neighbor. Wisconsin has overall a reputation as I think you could easily make a case for nominating it as the most racist city, Milwaukee, in the United States. The worst outcomes for black school children. Our prison system is clearly the most racist in the nation, maybe in the world. And there is a long history of these sorts of trials in cities like Milwaukee that usually become statewide news, but rarely national news. And there's a long history of how these things are handled. The number of successful prosecutions against police officers over many decades hovers somewhere around zero. And the way it's usually handled is if the case has sufficient press coverage where it's modulated through the news cycle to cause enough outrage and excitement that people get active about it and start making noise, or they take to the streets, or they're protesting long term or something. Often there will be a nominal sentence. It's important, I think, to remember that the guilt or innocence only is determined by the jury. The sentencing is done by a judge in trials like this. And so often what happens is one of these murderous policemen will actually be maybe jailed for a short period, which actually turns into, in a very brief period, parole, then probation, and a year later they turn up as policemen in Arizona or something. So I think this is the important part that is left out of these discussions that should be considered, and that media is very careful never to elucidate for people. So I just wanted to contribute that regional perspective to our next door neighbor here in Minnesota. For examples of how to handle this, you need only look next door.
Thank you so much for calling in and contributing today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Lee.
Leona from Michigan, you're on the air.
Greetings, you Therese, and greetings to your audience.
Thank you, and to you too.
Thank you. I want to thank you for offering this line of thinking today about this particular trial. I think it's an important trial, and I also feel gratitude to the folks who did the video documentation of this awful event, and gratitude to those who spoke up on May 25th, 2020. In terms of the jury, you asked a question about the jury. I'm thinking that, if members of the jury understand the system of racism, white supremacy, that will have a different result from a situation where the jury members do not understand the system of racism, white supremacy. The system of racism, white supremacy is a power equation of white over non-white. In fact, that image of Officer Chauvin with his knee on George Floyd's neck is an excellent, almost epitomize that. That image is an excellent image of what the system of racism, white supremacy is about. It's a war on non-white people in general, and a war on black men in particular. And it's about white power over non-white powerlessness. But anyway, I wanted to get to was in the trial. I just watched a little of it yesterday, and listening to what you said today, it sounds like the defense attorney is trying to, define an alternate reality, which is his job. And the system of racism, white supremacy, those who practice it, use a lot of deceit and violence. That's their main MO, deceit and violence. And the police, well, as I said before, I think that the ultimate culprit or the ultimate criminal in this case is the system of racism, white supremacy. But to get specific here, when they talk about Mr. Floyd having hypertension and things of that nature, a lot of victims of racism, white supremacy have hypertension from dealing with the everyday stress of living under this system. And let me wrap this up by saying this system operates in 9 areas of, people activity: economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war. I'm drawing from the work of Dr. Francis Kress Welsing and Neely Fuller, Jr. But what I wanted to ask you, Therese, was this may sound a little gross, but I would not be surprised, that white supremacy mindset and with Derek Chauvin on with his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck, I wouldn't be surprised if Chauvin experienced a sexual response, perhaps even an orgasm, while he had his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck.
Well, we don't know, and we shouldn't conjecture because there's no evidence of that.
Agreed, but I'm just saying, it wouldn't surprise me. This ongoing war between those who believe in white supremacy and those who don't. Hopefully, those who don't will win. And let me ask you this: While this trial is very important, but given that I don't know what else might this trial be diverting us from, be diverting people from. I intend to keep tabs on it as much as possible, but they're putting a lot of attention to it, and I don't know what they've given the family some money already, and what are they really trying to do with this trial, you think? Or maybe that's a question I shouldn't ask myself.
Well, it is clear that the trial is going to serve a lot of purposes, depending on who is driving the vehicle. But the general purpose here, as we are trying to pull this apart to see the component parts of this trial, it is for us to remember that we're talking about systems theory. People have been talking about it for years. We are all part of systems, all kinds of systems. And we are witnessing this a particular system working in a particular way to produce a particular result. Mm-hmm. We have to become far more conscious of systems, how they work, to achieve a predetermined outcome, so that this system you talk about of white supremacy can prevail. If it doesn't, there will be a problem. Because one of the things with these systems is that a lot of time is spent to keep them intact and inviolable. Nobody should be able to break them down, because they are vital to the concentration and the retention of power. In this particular system that we are examining here through a trial, we really are talking about systems. And what they're prepared to do and how they go about in a systematic way to arrive at a desired result, a tested result, and that is control of a community. Now, we could delude ourselves and think that it's just a trial. It's just a trial. No, it's not. It's about whether this system can hold up, and for how much longer can it hold up, if the people it was designed to control decide that they will destroy it because it doesn't work for them. So systems theory is a must in understanding how the United States works. Chauvin, whether he's a good cop or a bad cop, is part of a system of law enforcement. That's a system. And he may be part of other systems that we don't know anything about. Racial groups, ultra-right-wing groups, hate groups, we don't know. But he is part of a system. And we can see even this early in the course of the trial that the system has already found ways to protect itself through propaganda, through trying to reach our minds, through trying to persuade the jury that they're not seeing what they're seeing, they're not hearing what they're hearing, and they can't, for heaven's sake, they can't think on their own and put their own solution to this trial together. They're not supposed to be able to do that. So every now and again, we come to this point where systems are being tested. We think of them as trials. But handled well and opposed properly, we will see that it really is about confronting systems. They have the security of knowing how to make their systems work. But that doesn't mean we can't figure it out and develop a counter system.
Amen.
So let the church say amen for that little tirade there. But this is really what it is. It's if you study systems theory, you see how perfectly it defines what we are witnessing now. People think it's a trial. It's not.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Eutrice. Listen.
The system is being tested, but the system intends to prevail. So they will use whatever they can to make sure the system remains relatively intact. They'll patch up as they go.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. And it's important, needless to say, for people to understand this system, and I'm talking about myself, because in order to dismantle it, you got to first understand it.
Yes. And you also have to develop a system of your own.
Yes, ma'am. System of justice I'm looking at.
That's it.
Where nobody
Thanks
is
for
mistreated.
Talk today.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We have time to take at least another call or two at 888-874-4888. This is why I like to study things. Break it down. Don't just rely on the television stations or the news reports to tell you what is happening. As you can see from just the 2 days we've been discussing this in detail, people are seeing things and relating things that are becoming more and more evident to them because they may not know it, but they're into systems theory. And this case is a lot about systems theory. Oh, I see a little note here. Brother David is back. Yes, David, you're on the air.
I want to jump into this real quick because the system that we're talking about is divide and rule. That's the basic system. And it has different elements, and one of it is the element of white phenotype rule. So that's what we're faced with. The only way that this place can work, this country called the USA, United States of America, is to keep people divided. You have to divide them up and rule, and you can do it by this false concept of race and basing people's value on their phenotype or any other way you can divide people up. That's the only way you can rule. The ruling class controls politically, economically, and all aspects of government, whether it's judiciary, the legislative or executive, and that's the way you do it. You have a system to control the masses of people. So the system is called divide and conquer, and white supremacy, racism, is another one foundation in that system as I see it.
All right. Thanks for calling back and adding to your previous offering today. When these kinds of trials occur, it is very, very instructive to pause and pay attention to what is happening in a court of law. But to divorce yourself in a way from that scenario, because it is, in fact, a form of diversion. They're not going to get anywhere close to what brought George Floyd and Derek Chauvin together. What brought them into contact with each other, and what was the consequence of that contact? It was death. It usually is for people of color. You pay with your life. But we seldom think of these things as systems, and yet almost everybody else does. Everybody else has a system of some sort or another that meets an appropriate need that they have. Systems are not bad, necessarily. They're simply designed to meet the needs of people who have things in common. Maybe they want a new school. Maybe they want a new housing project. But systems are what deliver these things in our society. And we have to understand systems a bit more thoroughly than we do, and understand the need to hurry up and devise our own systems. That's a very important task that we have before us. So look at the trial, look at all the things that are supposedly being said, but listen for those things that are not being said. It's easy to tell what is being said. All you have to do is just to remove your air plugs and you'll hear it. But you have to discern what is not being said, even in a trial like this. And even though it applies to one man named George Floyd, we are all George Floyd. And so we have to extend the meaning of these things to ourselves, our present condition. George Floyd is us. We are George Floyd. And now the system is going to grapple with how to appear to be completely honest and well-intentioned. Although we can see from the word go that certain decisions have been made about how this case ought to turn out. You see? So don't put 100% of your trust and credibility on the line. Be very skeptical and think a lot about what it is you allegedly are seeing or being shown or being told. It's not like that. You have to discern the various levels of meaning every now and then when we have an opportunity in a situation like this of being one to analyze and learn how this system works. I want to thank you so much for your contributions and for taking such an active interest in this case. We ought to all take an active interest in this case. We've come to this point so many times, but seldom do we discuss the levels of meaning and how they pertain to us in our everyday lives. So thank you for that. And we'll join each other again tomorrow, see what else we're going to talk about. Bye-bye.